Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today's Wednesday. It's August 23rd, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. My name is Hezzy Eris. So we're going to try to cover some important and pertinent local, local and state and national, as well as international news with commensurate analysis. And hopefully you'll be able to join us for the day. One of the most important things that's happened, of course, is that Governor Hochul has signed a bill to protect the Hudson River from Indian Point decommissioning wastewater. This is new legislation. It's going to protect the Hudson River by restricting discharges in connection with nuclear power plant decommissioning. So I don't know what they're going to do when they say with the term of restricting discharges. Does that mean it's going to take longer to discharge? Or how is it going to be done? And it's very interesting when you come to think about it that when they commissioned a nuclear power plant, they never mentioned, or maybe it went beyond my capacity to think it out. I thought there were all sorts of safety features, but they never mentioned that I remember that they would have to discharge the fluid, the water, eventually when the nuclear power plant would be decommissioned, which is unbelievable when you come to think of it. So here's technology that failed at the end of the day, even though it generated so much power. At the end of the day, it's going to be detrimental because what are you going to do with the wastewater? And where is it going to go? And once it's released into the ocean, what's it going to do to the ecology? What about all the animal life that will be diminished and possibly get an infliction of, who knows, some sort of chemical change to their bodies? They may become sterile. May kill a lot of wildlife that we need as food. And what about the plant life? These are unanswered questions, and unfortunately, it's going to become problematic because we don't know the result of all of these things. And we're probably not going to know about it for years to come, no matter what will occur and what they're going to do with the decommissioning process and what they're going to do about cleaning up the wastewater. And there's no talk about it either. That's the thing that's really amazing. So here the governor is talking about restricting discharges. So does that mean that we're going to restrict it to, you know, discharging only 5% at any given moment? And even so, it's going to have an effect. So the question is, what do we do with it? Should it be buried underground? And will that seep into the water system anyway? I mean, how far do you have to go before you kill it? Before you destroy it all. And I think these are really major, major issues. And the media is not doing a good job in deciphering what should be done with it and even why it's got to the point where we've utilized this water and there has been no scientific work that has been published that I'm aware of, which doesn't make it finite. They or may have been, but certainly it's not in the public realm so that most people are aware of it, or many people are aware of it. So you could say, well, it was made public, how we're going to take care of this issue or how we're going to mitigate this issue other than just dumping it into the ocean, which is going to affect probably the ecological framework and function of the ocean. And who knows what it could do and what it could cause. it could kill a tremendous amount of flora and fauna and animal life. And what is that going to do? And can you imagine that if they do disperse this water into the oceans, it may affect the ability for animal life to be culled, and whether it be fish or whether it be shrimp or whether it be lobster or other shellfish, we're going to be able to eat that. Well, if you're kosher, you're not going to be eating lobster and shrimp, but there are other fish that are regarded as kosher, and so what's going to happen to all that stuff? And that's what I don't know. It really is fascinating where we're going to go with all of this. And the best part of all is it's not being answered by any political or scientific body out there. So term like there's going to be a restriction of the discharges in connection with the nuclear power plant decommissioning doesn't explain what the term restricting discharges means. And the point of it all of it is, at the end of the day, whether you restrict it to 1% of the fluid that needs to be discharged at any given time, or does that mean that if you only disperse disperse, like, let's say, 1% of the fluid at any given time, and even if you keep it a month apart or a year apart, is that going to be okay? And it becomes questionable. Answer to what this will mitigate, if anything at all. What does the term restricting discharges mean? These are terms that are innocuous because they don't explain exactly what they do. And that is really, it's tremendous difficulty, because these are radiological substances which are going to be dumped into the Hudson River, and they're not going to be mitigated by being dispersed among the larger ocean where it's going to be dumped, in the Atlantic Ocean. So I just don't understand the stupidity of it all, but I guess at the end of the day, this seems to be okay. For the governor to issue this is a little bit mind-boggling, because you would think that at the end of the day we could do something different. Then what's interesting is the state senator, Pete Harkin, said, quote, "Thank you, Governor Hochul, for signing the Save the Hudson bill and protecting one of our country's most important natural resources." How is it protected? Even if it's going to, the landmark law prevents the release of radioactive wastewater into the river and protects the robust economic vitality of the region. How so? Where is it going to be dumped? They don't explain that. So why is Senator Hark coming in on this thing? In what way is this a solution? And he says, "We stand ready to work with all stakeholders to find alternative solutions to this challenge and to continue the timely and safe decommissioning of the Indian Point power plants." What kind of BS is this? What is this supposed to mean? Oh, Assembly Member Dana Levenberg, she's another one. "The signing," quote, "the signing of this bill comes as such a welcome news to so many people in my district and far beyond." She writes, "Today, I say thank you to Governor Hochul and her office for carefully considering this legislation, and to my colleagues at the federal, state, and local levels for their support. I am also incredibly grateful to the advocates who dedicated countless hours alongside us legislators working to get this legislation passed. So many people in the Hudson Valley showed up to this fight, determined to protect the river that defines our region, and we will continue to work together Well, how does this comply with the governor saying that she's going to do it on a disperse the water on in a gradual manner? And how is that going to mitigate anything? You know, this is double speak, and it doesn't say exactly what's going to be done and how it's going to mitigate the negative influence of this very toxic fluid, which is radioactive, and how is that going to be mitigated if you dump it into the ocean as opposed to the rivers? Oh, you know, give me a break. It's all going to come back one way or the other to haunt us, because it's going to kill the plant life and the animal life in the oceans. And that's going to affect everybody. What about all the people that are going to go fishing? What about the fishermen whose livelihood is in the oceans? How is this going to work? And the answer is, we don't have an answer. And that's a real problem. It is outrageous that all these people are jumping in. Another one, Scenic Hudson President Ned Sullivan says, quote, this critically important legislation will prevent Holtec International, the company responsible for decommissioning Indian Point, from dumping over 1 million gallons of radioactive wastewater into the Hudson River. Really? How are they going to get rid of it then? What are they going to do with it? Where is it going to be stored? We don't know that answer. So Ned Sullivan continues, the bill sends an important message to New Yorkers. The Hudson River is a source of our collective prosperity, not a dumping ground for industrial waste. That's a given. The people of the Hudson Valley, he continues, offer their deepest thanks to Governor Hochul for her continued steadfast leadership in protecting the Hudson River and the many communities that rely on it for their health, recreation, and economic prosperity. We also recognize and applaud bill sponsor Assemblywoman Levenberg, Senator Harkin, and their colleagues, as well as Riverkeeper, for the dedication and highly effective advocacy. Well, what are they advocated? What are we going to do with the water? Isn't it interesting that what are we going to do with the radioactive discharges? How is it going to be done? Amazing. And then signing the, quote, Save the Hudson legislation serves not just as resistance to detrimental radioactive discharges, but also as a signpost pointing towards a brighter, cleaner, and more sustainable future in New York's residents and crucial waterways, one river at a time. Unbelievable. And what is that remedy? It escapes us because it's not written in any of the media that they've given. This is insanity. Oh, another one here. Northeast Region Director at Food and Water Watch, Alex Beauchamp, said, quote, Governor Hochul is sending a strong signal to corporate polluters. Industrial waste has no place in our water. The Save the Hudson bill will ensure that the Hudson River is no longer treated as a toxic dumping ground, prioritizing public health and the environment over corporate expediency. Holtec's plan to dump radioactive water in the Hudson River was dangerous from the start, and New Yorkers from all over the state quickly organized robust opposition. Today we celebrate the power of our communities over corporations and thank Governor Hochul for keeping our river safe. Well, that's the intention, but at the beginning of her press notice, she says, let me go back here. She signed the legislation, Senate Bill 6893 and Assembly Bill 7208 into law, which is intended to protect the economic vitality of the Hudson River region by restricting discharges of any radiological substance into the Hudson River in connection with the decommissioning of the nuclear power plant. So where is this fluid going to go? What are you going to do with it? How do you decommission the radiological substances in the river water, not in the river water, but in the water that was part of the nuclear power plant? And why wasn't this asked at the very beginning when they approved Holtec's building this nuclear power plant? It's all for money at the end of the day, and they scoff at the health of the people who live in the state, as well as in other communities beside New York State. This is going to affect everybody because we still don't know what they're going to do with the radioactive water, where they're going to store it. It's going to pollute something, and we don't know what it's going to do. Even if you bury it, who knows how deep into the ocean, into the Earth's crust. What are you going to do with it? It doesn't make any sense. Are they going to be able to lift it up into some spacecraft and just jettison it out into space? Really? Isn't that going to affect other things as well? I mean, it is so insane what's really going on here. It is really pathetic that this is the terminology that we see being written. And it's just not good. There is no solution here, but a lot of beautiful writing that is nebulous in its content because it doesn't explain what they're going to do with the radioactive fluid that was permeating throughout the nuclear power plant. Where is it going to go? How is that going to be decommissioned, as is Indian Point being commissioned? How are we going to abrogate all these concerns? And I just don't see it. And hey, maybe that's what it takes. It takes somebody who learned the English language to recognize that the language being used is innocuous and says nothing. Absolutely a nebulous term that means absolutely nothing at all. But it seems to sound good for a lot of people in elected office. And they're all jumping in, supporting the governor's statement. I don't know who wrote it for the governor. If she wrote it herself, I doubt it. They probably had a whole gang of people coming up with this concept and the terminology, which is totally innocuous. It says nothing, it explains nothing, and it reveals nothing at the end of the day. And we still don't know what they're going to do with the wastewater. Where is it going to go? And what are you going to do with it? And why did you even approve the commissioning of the nuclear power plant if you didn't know what you were going to do with the water? See the failure from beginning to end. From beginning to end, it is still toxic. It was toxic from the beginning. It's toxic now. And they're still building nuclear power plants, and they don't know what to do with the water that is going to become part and parcel radioactive. What do we do with all of this? And isn't it interesting they don't mention the other nuclear power plants in the nation, as well as on the world stage? Literally on the world stage. Has anyone figured it out? And the answer is probably no. I can't be 100% certain because I haven't studied the others. But the bottom line is this one has not been commissioned correctly, and nor has it been decommissioned correctly. And we don't have any way to make sure that this toxic waste is going to not seep into our environmental structure, and it may denigrate every aspect of our future health. It is absolutely amazing that this is permitted. Well, so it goes. Now, let's look at some other things which you may find of interest. Oh, gosh. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Well, let's look at what's really happened on the international stage, which I think you'll find interesting. India has become the first nation to land spacecraft on the moon's south pole. Well, India on Wednesday made history when its Chandrayaan-3 lander successfully touched on the moon's south pole thought to be a potential source for water and oxygen days after Russia's mission had failed. Well, the Indian Space Agency launched the rocket on July 14th, blasting off from the country's main spaceport in the southern state of Andhra Pradesh. The moon landing is a historic moment for the world's most populous nation as it rapidly closes in on a milestone set by global space powers. Chandrayaan-3, which means mooncraft in Sanskrit, touched down shortly after 6 p.m. India time, which is 12:30 Greenwich Mean Time, near the little-explored lunar South Pole. A previous Indian effort failed back in 2019, and today's success comes just days after Russia's first moon mission in almost 50 years, destined for the same region, crashed on the lunar surface. K. Sivan, S-I-V-A-N, the former head of the Indian Space Research Organization, known as ISRO, said it had made corrections after the failure of 4 years ago, when scientists lost control with the previous lunar module moments before its slated landing. Chandrayaan-3 is going to go with more ruggedness, he said prior to the successful landing. We have confidence and we expect that everything will go smoothly, end quote. Well, the mission was launched nearly 6 weeks ago in front of thousands of cheering spectators, but took much longer to reach the moon than those of the Apollo mission in the 1960s and 1970s, which arrived in a matter of days. India is using rockets much less powerful than those the United States used back then, meaning the probe needed to orbit Earth several times to gain speed before embarking on its month-long lunar trajectory lander, known as Vikram, which means valor in Sanskrit. Detached from its propulsion module last week, and has been sending back images of the moon's surface since entering lunar orbit on August 5. Well, a day ahead of the landing, the ISRO said on social media that the landing was proceeding on schedule and that its mission control complex was, quote, buzzed with energy and excitement, end quote. Quote, smooth sailing is continuing, end quote, the agency posted on X, formerly known as Twitter. And the moon, as captured by the lander imager camera 4 on August 20. 2023. So India has a comparatively low-budget aerospace program, but one that has grown considerably in size and momentum since it first sent a probe to orbit the moon back in 2008. So the latest mission comes with a price tag of $74.6 million, far lower than those of other countries, and a testament to India's frugal space engineering. Experts say that India can keep costs low by copying and adapting existing space technology, and thanks to the abundance of highly skilled engineers who earn a fraction of their foreign counterparts' wages. In 2014, India became the first Asian nation to put a satellite into orbit around Mars and is slated to launch a three-day manned mission into Earth's orbit. Well, Sivan, the former ISRO chief, said that India's efforts to explore the relatively unmapped lunar South Pole would make a very, very important, quote-unquote, contribution to scientific knowledge. Only Russia, the United States, and China have previously achieved a controlled landing on the lunar surface. So Russia launched its own lunar probe earlier in August, its first in nearly half a century. If successful, it would have beaten Chandrayaan-3 by a matter of days to become the first mission of any nation to make a controlled landing around the lunar South Pole. But the Luna 25 probe crash landed on Saturday after an unspecified incident as it was preparing for descent. Punishing sanctions since the outset of the war in Ukraine have affected Russia's space industry, which has also been beleaguered by corruption and a lack of innovation and partnerships. So those are some of the major issues that have come into play. Then let's look at some other things that are happening on the world stage. Bear with me a second. Greek firefighters are battling major blazes on multiple fronts. Teams of Greek firefighters on Wednesday struggled to contain uncontrolled fires throughout the country for a fifth day, several of them bordering an acrid, smoke-filled Athens. In the last 2 days, 19 people believed to be migrants, including two children, have been killed in forest fires. A fire fanned by strong winds ripped through the foothills of Mount Parnita, the largest forest adjoining the capital, burning near the outskirts of a national park and threatening a casino in the area. Evacuations were ordered on Wednesday morning for several settlements in the area, including three nursing homes. The blaze damaged homes in the northwestern Athens district of Menidi, which is also close to a military camp. Quote, many people don't want to leave their homes, Nikos Kontronikalis, a Hellenic Red Cross organizer, told State TV ERT in Menidi. We found some elderly people who had fainted in their own yards, he said, adding that his team had treated several residents for burns and respiratory problems. Quote, fires have already destroyed homes and properties in nearby suburbs of Hastia and Fili. A migrant detention center in Amig Veleza, north of Athens, was also evacuated. Greek firefighters have battled over 350 fires over the last 5 days, including over 200 in the last 48 hours. Civil Protection Minister Vasilis Kikilias told an emergency news conference. Quote, in 32 years of service, I've never seen such extreme conditions, end quote, the Greek fire department chief Yorgos Pounaras told reporters, noting that even during the night, winds remained high. Parnita fire had spread even though water bombers were on site in minutes, Pounaras had said. The Greek capital woke up Wednesday to the smell of scorched black smoke covering the sky. Unfortunately, the wind does not help at all. Stathis Topalidis, the deputy mayor of Menidi, told State TV ERT. On Tuesday, authorities ordered the evacuation of Ano Liosia in the northwest, in northwest Athens, a district of over 25,000 people, although several stayed in their homes. To try and protect their properties. Conditions remain difficult and in many cases extreme, fire department spokesman Yanis Atropios had said in a televised address. Another big blaze was still raging at a landfill in the industrial zone of Aspropyrgos, west of Athens. Flames continued to spread unchecked for a fifth day in the northeastern region of Evros, close to the Turkish border in Alexandropoulos and the Dadia forest and home to rare birds of prey. More evacuations were ordered in the region overnight. Then there are online rumors. Unfounded rumors and allegations have also been spreading rapidly on social media that blame migrants for responsibility for the outbreaks of the fires. Greece's Supreme Court prosecutor on Wednesday ordered local officials to investigate both the causes of the catastrophic fire and alleged claims of racism toward migrants. Greek authorities on Tuesday arrested three people in northern Greece who had forced undocumented migrants into a cargo trailer, blaming them for being responsible for the fires. The detainees posted a video on social media urging more people to do the same. Well, 18 people, including two children, were found dead on Tuesday in a forest fire near the Turkish border, north of Alexandropoulos. As no local residents have been reported missing, the possibility that they are people entered our country illegally is under investigation, the fire department spokesman Yanis Antolpios had said in a televised address. Another person, believed to be a migrant, was found dead on Monday. Fires were also raging on the islands of Evia and Tithnos, the region of Boeotia, north of Athens, and in western Greece. Over 40,000 hectares, that's nearly 99,000 acres, were destroyed in wildfires in just 3 days from August 19 to 21, according to a report by the National Observatory of Athens. The very hot and dry conditions which increase the fire risk will persist until Friday, according to meteorologists. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Oh, God. 1 second here. All right, let me just look at some other thing, which you may find of interest. Bear with me a second. I wanted to look into this. Morocco breaks a heat record. Seems that temperatures in Morocco have, for the first time on record, topped 50 degrees Celsius. It's 120 degrees Fahrenheit. The North African country's meteorological service said on Sunday amid a scorching heat wave. While the meteorological station in the southern coastal city of Agadir recorded on Friday the new national record of 50.4 degrees centigrade, said the General Directorate of Meteorology. Well, Morocco has experienced a series of heat waves over the summer with record-breaking temperatures. The previous highest record of 49.9 degrees Celsius in the western Sahara city of Samarra was recorded on July 13, according to the Weather Service. This heat wave is due to the influx of dry and hot air from the south, causing a significant rise in temperatures, surpassing the monthly average of 5 to 13 degrees, the meteorological authority said in a statement. Well, the heat wave has caused wildfires in recent days in northern Morocco, near Tangier, and further east in Taza province, damaging forests but resulting in no casualties. July has been the hottest month ever recorded on Earth, according to the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service. It surpassed the previous record on July 2019 by 0.33 degrees Celsius. So last month in Morocco was ranked the fourth hottest July since 1961. Weather forecasts predict a slight drop in temperatures in the coming days across the northern parts of North Africa. So we'll see where all that goes. One second. Bear with me a moment here. Let's look at what's happening in France. Evidently, Macron, the president, weighs up referendums to break the political deadlock in the French parliament. It seems that French President Emmanuel Macron told his government on Wednesday he was considering referendums to pass legislation and break the political deadlock caused by the country's hung parliament, several sources advised. Well, Macron told cabinet members he would hold talks with all rival political leaders next week with a view to drawing up, quote, draft legislation, but also referendums, end quote, the sources said, on condition of anonymity without giving further details. 45-year-old leader announced in early August that he was planning a major political initiative after his summer holidays. Well, the government has succeeded in negotiating some new laws with the support of opposition parties, but Macron's flagship pension reform earlier this year had to be rammed through using emergency executive powers, outraging many voters. Macron, who likes to claim reforming France is part of his political DNA, is desperate to relaunch his second and final term in office, which has been bogged down following his failure to secure a majority in parliamentary elections back in June of 2022. Rumors about referendums have swirled before during his 6 years in office, notably after the so-called yellow vest and quote anti-government protest back in 2018 to 2019, when the centrist wanted to reduce the number of national lawmakers. Well, unlike France's Fifth Republic, which began in 1958, the president is able to call national referendums, but the power has been used only 9 times since then. It was last invoked in 2005 for a referendum on a new European constitution, which the government of then-president Jacques Chirac lost in a shock setback. Talks last week will see Macron convene all the leaders of opposition political parties, including Marine Le Pen, from the far-right National Rally, with whom the president has previously refused to negotiate. While the government's immediate priorities include passing legislation to tackle illegal immigration and crime, while it also expected to face severe difficulties in securing a majority of its 2023-2024 budget. So faced with a large deficit and pressure from international ratings agencies, the government has promised to take what are likely to be unpopular steps to balance the books, including tax rises and cuts to public spending. Quote, there is no question. It's not at all part of the philosophy of the government to increase taxes for consumers, Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne said on Wednesday during a radio interview. The ability to call referendums is one of the many tools at the disposal of France's all-powerful president, but they are considered politically risky because voters in opposition parties can use the opportunity to rebuke the government. So as a last resort, Macron is also able to dissolve parliament and call new elections. But analysts suggest he is unlikely to do this because, or given the weaknesses and divisions among his allies and the relative strength of Le Pen's far-right movement. This year's widely disliked pension reform saw Macron's ratings fall to near record lows, while 5 days of nationwide rioting in July took the country and were seen as being politically helpful for Le Pen and her anti-immigration agenda. So those are the issues coming out of France right now. So we'll see where that goes. Now, let's look at this, because this is very, very telling. The expansion in a common currency is on the agenda at the BRICS summit. Leaders of some of the developing world's most important economies turned Wednesday to the main business of their summit in South Africa, a day after a speech by Russian President Vladimir Putin, which gave the gathering an anti-Western tinge that officials had been hoping to avoid. Well, the BRICS group of emerging economies made up of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa is debating whether to expand the bloc and allow new members more than a decade after it came into existence. More than 20 countries have formally applied to join the group, officials say, with Saudi Arabia one of the most significant. 4 of the bloc's leaders, including Chinese President Xi Jinping, are in Johannesburg for the group's first in-person meeting since the COVID-19 pandemic. Putin is not attending after an international criminal court arrest warrant for him over the war in Ukraine complicated his travel to South Africa, but he is participating virtually. And, One second. Move this forward. One moment here. Bear with me. Let's go over to Hawaii before we move on. At least 1,100 people are missing after the Hawaii fires as the FBI seeks to help in identifying the dead. At least 1,100 people are still missing 2 weeks after the deadly wildfires ravaged the Hawaiian island of Maui, authorities said yesterday, with the FBI seeking family members' help in identifying the remains of the dead. The fires were the deadliest to hit the United States in a century, claiming at least 115 lives, according to the latest provisional death toll. The tourist town of Lahaina, home to 12,000 people, was all but wiped off the map, with thousands of missing persons appearing on lists maintained by various organizations, including the police, Red Cross, and shelters. Well, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is now working to collate and verify the data. Special Agent Stephen Merrill told reporters on Tuesday, quote, we're cross-referencing all the lists so that we can determine who, in fact, truly is still unaccounted for, Merrill had said. As of Tuesday, the FBI had counted 1,100 missing persons, he added, where the number likely to rise. The FBI has set up a dedicated telephone hotline and has encouraged relatives of the missing to contact them. We really need the public's help, said Merrill, particularly in terms of putting additional information to verify details to some of the missing. Well, Maui Police Chief John Pelletier said that authorities were refining the data and were hoping to publish a verified list of missing persons, quote, in the next few days, end quote. Well, FBI police agents have also been collecting DNA samples from the families of the missing who are unable to travel to Maui whenever in the world they may be. Wherever in the world they may be. So the FBI Honolulu is assisting the Maui Police Department and Maui Emergency Management Agency to locate and identify those who are missing or may be victims in the wildfire in Lahaina, Hawaii, by helping collect DNA samples from family members. Identifying unrecognizable bodies found in the ashes of Lahaina as a laborious task. So far, only 27 of the 115 validly accepted children's visas are going to be allowed into two islands in order to mitigate their storm into the living quarters. It's just too much. Anyway, so that's a story for us today. Hopefully you'll join us tomorrow. Take care and be well. Thanks for being with us. Goodbye.